Deadly Cereal contains graphic depictions and is intended for mature audiences only. Listener discretion is advised. Please do not take us seriously. We don't.
Welcome to Deadly Cereal. I am Lee Moffitt. With me, as always, is Laura Dedrick.
Welcome, everyone. Hello. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing so great.
Me too. It's still a winter wonderland out there from yesterday. So, hey, but I have power, man. That's good.
I'm so glad that you have power. And they said that you were going to be out a week. That is unacceptable.
Yeah, we live in the middle of town, and we had a big ice storm blow through here yesterday, guys. And our power went out probably about 10 times yesterday, and they said it wasn't going to be back on until the beginning of next week. But since we're tied to so many businesses, we live right in town, we got it back on, which is, thank God. I'm scared of the dark.
Yeah.
So I don't like it. Yeah, I need my power.
Yeah, power is nice. It's nice to have warm water and all the things that we take for granted.
I agree. I would have never made it in any other century.
Absolutely not. No way. I wouldn't no last way. 5 minutes.
I'm a pansy ass, and I need my power and my water. My washing machine.
We live in a society.
We live in a society.
It's not my... I didn't do this. I'm not going back. I'm not going back to the Stone Age.
Well, I don't know, man. We might have to. I don't know the way things are going.
Well, if it happens, oh well.
I won't last. I know I won't last.
No, I'll be the first to go.
Yeah.
Oh well.
Yeah.
It's fine.
We'll just take each day as it comes.
Like we're doing now.
Right.
That's all we can do.
That's all you can do, especially in these times.
Live life like it's the apocalypse.
Yes.
And you have less than 10 minutes to live. No, that's a little too much.
That's a little extreme.
Let's say 48 hours.
Okay, that's better. Yeah. People that knew they had 10 minutes to live, it would be like the purge.
Chaos.
Yeah, it'd be. I also wanted to tell you that I saw this really good documentary on HBO Max. We're just like HBO Max in it right now because
there's so much good stuff on it.
There's a lot of good stuff on there. It's really interesting. It's called Crazy Not Insane. I'm only 30 minutes into it, but it's very interesting about serial killers and their brain chemistry and their history and possible multiple personality disorders. It's really cool. So you definitely need to check it out. It's really good.
Yeah, I'm gonna watch that tonight.
Yeah.
Did you take your Christmas tree down?
I did. I did two things wrong recently. I took down my Christmas tree early, which is supposed to be really bad luck. And I didn't think about it. And I did laundry on New Year's Day, which means someone in your family is supposed to wash away, aka die. But okay, so that's fucked up. I didn't know
that's
about
that. That's really fucked up.
Yeah.
Just dude. Okay. You don't need any extra motivation to do your laundry. And then you certainly don't need any of that.
I know. I did like several loads. I was like, well, okay, fuck it. And I didn't know about that superstition until this year. I think it might've been a Facebook thing, to be honest with you.
I didn't learn about a lot of the superstitions until this year. The one where you open up the windows and the doors and let out 2020.
I didn't know about that. Apparently people eat black eyed peas. Didn't know that.
Some people listen to black eyed peas.
Yeah.
I don't judge either one of them.
Oh gosh. So yeah, I was bad. I broke some superstitions, but the tree had to go. Like I just got it in my head. Like everything has to be gone now. Like I can't deal with this anymore.
You had an idea.
Yep.
That was planted in your head. Like, What would it be like to have a clean, empty living room?
Yeah.
And you did not stop until you...
Like, it has to be done, and it has to be done that day. I'm just very set in my ways. I don't know. I just knew I needed to get it out of there, and now I have a back to normal, back to real life living room. So it's good. Well, and bathroom. Cause and kitchen. So, you know, I decorated the whole fucking house this year.
Well, it's day two in 2021. And inside my living room is like a Christmas present.
See, this is the day you're supposed to take it down, apparently.
The second.
Yeah, the day after New Year's.
Then I shall do that.
Yeah. But whatever. I over-decorated this year. I was just trying to find any kind of serotonin boost I could through the holidays since we had a socially distanced Christmas. But we're moving on. It'll be summer before we know it. Things will get better.
Oh, yeah.
After Christmas, I'm just done with winter. I'm ready for summer.
Yep. When spring.
Yeah. I'm over it. I hate winter. Ready to get started?
Let's get into it.
All right, let's get into this. Okay. This week, we are talking about John List. John Emil List, a.k.a. the Boogeyman of Westfield, which is a terrible name. We already talked about
That's the worst name. It's so generic.
Very uninspired. Was born September 17th, 1925 in Bay City, Michigan. His parents, John Frederick List and Alma Marie Barbara Florence List, were German-American immigrants. His parents were devout Lutherans, and he was raised in the church from an early age.
Very, very church-going guy.
Yes, he was big in the church. He was an only child and was often described as aloof and cold. He wasn't known for having many friends. His father was a harsh, strict man, but John's mother always doted on him. She was overprotective and strict as well, but they were always close.
Yeah, he's always been like one of those guys like, oh man, it's this guy.
Yeah. Oh, it's John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to live with. But I mean, if you're oblivious to it, I guess it doesn't matter.
He probably was. John served in the U.S. Army as a second lieutenant during World War II, later getting a bachelor's degree in business administration and a master's in accounting from the University of Michigan. So he was an educated guy.
I also did a little research. He was no slouch in the military, apparently. He had several tours, and he actually saw some action. So
did he?
PTSD, yeah.
Okay, okay.
It's totally valid.
Okay, okay. In November 1950, John was recalled by the Army during the escalation of the Korean War. At Fort Eustis, Virginia, he met Helen Morris Taylor. She was a widow of an infantry officer killed in action in Korea. She lived nearby with her daughter, and she had told John that she was pregnant with his child. Him being religious, married her right away on December 1st, 1951. She did lie about being pregnant.
It's the old switcheroo.
It's yeah. Messed up.
It's never a good thing to do.
No, because it's going to come out eventually when it doesn't come out. 9 months later. He resented her for this, but stayed married to her. And they wasted no time in actually getting pregnant, however. And within 4 years, the pair had three kids.
Here's what you do. Once you find out that she's lying about not being pregnant, just go.
Yeah, but sleep. He's really big about non-confrontation with his wife. He had already married her, so divorce was not really something that he wanted to do. So he stayed with her and then had three kids with her. John felt a lot of pressure to provide for his family, but he had a hard time holding on a job, like we talked about before. He had a great work ethic, but it was said that he would be let go from jobs frequently because he just rubbed his coworkers and bosses the wrong way. He was just that type of guy. He was just a little off.
Yeah, he rubs me the wrong way every time I hear him talk.
Yeah, I don't like to hear him talk either. He rubs me the wrong way. I can totally understand where they're coming from.
He has zero remorse.
No, he doesn't care.
He's saying all of these horrible things like they're facts. You mm-hmm. know, like they're just, he says it so casually.
He does. He's very laissez-faire about what he did. He did end up getting a job as a vice president of a bank in New Jersey, which is a really good job. Good money.
Yeah, it is. Vice president. Wow.
Yeah. And for a while, things were great. The family went to church every Sunday, where John taught Sunday school, And at this time, Helen insisted they purchase her dream home. This house was a 19-room mansion in the most expensive part of town. It had a name. It was called Breeze Knoll. The house had marble fireplaces, elegant ballrooms. It also had a stained glass bathroom ceiling. So it was a very fancy house with a name.
I like the stained glass thing that you can look at while you're taking a piss.
Yeah, it's nice. Unfortunately, they could not afford the Breeze Knoll, but Helen was all about this place. And John didn't want to cause a confrontation with his wife, so he went to his mother to ask for a loan. She lent him the money he needed. Huh?
The house is huge.
It's big. It's creepy. She lent him the money he needed, and in exchange, she would live in an apartment on the third floor of the mansion. It was a self-contained apartment, had a kitchen, bathroom, bedroom, everything she needed up there. She had her own little space up there, which is cool.
Very cool.
Within the year, he was fired from his bank job, again, because of personality clashes.
Within a year. Mm-hmm. Like, he's had this job not even a year, and they're already saying, oh, we got a mansion, let's fucking party, living life. Like, so, yeah.
A year. I bet you they creeped him out within the first month, and they spent 11 more months trying to figure out how to get rid of him without being sued. Since he has such a good work ethic, they're like, how do we get rid of creepy John? God, he's got to go.
Oh, man, it's so tough to get rid of those guys when they show up to work every single day.
I don't do anything wrong. It's terrible to be around. John decided not to tell his family that he lost his job. Okay. He didn't want to face their disappointment of him losing yet another job. And Helen was obsessed with this mansion and the whole lifestyle. He felt like he couldn't face the confrontation. Once again, very non-confrontational guy. Maybe he should have had a little more confrontations in his life.
It's a bold move. Not telling anybody. And absolutely, he could have learned a thing or two from confrontations.
Healthy confrontation is a thing.
It is.
It's necessary. So you don't snap one day, I guess.
Yeah.
So he didn't tell him he lost his job. Well, what did he do? Well, he would wake up every morning, get dressed, and go to work. He would head to the train station during his quote-unquote work day. There he would read and nap, hopping different trains throughout the day, contemplating his next move.
That's literally a SpongeBob episode.
Which one? Where Patrick...
Yeah, it's one they have the baby clam.
Yeah.
And then Patrick goes to work, quotes, and all he's doing is sitting on his ass watching TV. Eating donuts.
That's funny. It also kind of reminds me of Seinfeld, where Kramer got the job, but he didn't really work there, and he kept crackers.
My baby takes the morning train.
I made a dinner, which was for two, by the way. That's a good episode. What do you keep in there? Crackers. Keeps crackers in his briefcase.
It's killing him. It's killing
us. He did find another job, although it was a much lower paying job, but he lost that one too. And this happened over and over. He would get a job and he would lose it. And he never made as much money as he made when he moved into Breeze Knoll when he was working at the bank.
And he will never make that much money again.
Nope. He had been taking money out of his mom's account just to pay the mortgage. And by 1971, John was completely bankrupt. Being the devout in his religion as he was, he believed that poverty was a sin.
Yeah, if you're poor, you're going to hell. That sucks.
I never thought about that. I don't think it is. I guess it's a shame. I don't know. What?
I don't know either. If you're poor, it's not a sin. Help it. No, if anything, rich people are sinful.
Right? Yeah.
So if you're rich, fuck you.
We're talking to you, Bezos. Hey, fuck you.
Yeah.
During this time, John's three children were teenagers. He believed that they were turning towards sin. This was the 70s. A lot of sin in the 70s, apparently, you know.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
What?
You left out a very crucial part.
Uh-oh.
Is that he met a young 20-year-old before all of this happened. And it kind of sparked the idea.
No.
Like, yeah.
I did not see
that. A young girl. She was kind. She wasn't into him. She like flirted with him once. And then he like took it way too far. And he thought of all of these things to do, and it's not good. It's bad.
Oh my goodness. So did they have like a relationship, or did he just was inspired by a young lady being interested in him? Or
he was inspired and he didn't even pursue it afterwards. It was just the thought of something different, something new.
Do you think it was like, in a way, like a midlife crisis kind of, perhaps?
Yeah.
Well, there's other factors, but
if he could possibly go through a midlife crisis, this is a very interesting guy.
Yeah, he is. And it's not like he bought a convertible. I mean, you know, he was especially worried about his daughter, Patricia, who was 16 years old. She wanted to be an actor, which apparently wasn't an acceptable profession in his eyes. He believed that it was corrupt and associated with the devil. He also believed she was dabbling in witchcraft and experimenting with marijuana.
This is all bullshit.
Hold on. She's 16 years old. Of course she is. This is the 70s.
It's the 70s, yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Real thing. Also, his wife Helen was having serious health issues. She was experiencing blackouts. She would fall down a lot. She got into drinking and taking tranquilizers. She had actually been diagnosed with syphilis. She had gotten it from her first husband that had died in action. She initially didn't tell John about this diagnosis, and she passed it on to him. He was very betrayed when he found out, which is understandable.
See, now that I didn't know about. That's on the documentary left out, that she gave him syphilis.
She had syphilis, so.
And gave it to him?
Yeah.
That's fucked up, man.
I know. And John was absolutely mortified by his money situation. Welfare or charity was not an option for him in his eyes. He thought about killing himself, but in his religion, suicide is a mortal sin, so he couldn't do that. And he started to worry about his family's eternal salvation. So that.
But what does it say about murder?
It's one of the Ten Commandments. I know that. So that's kind of a big deal.
Offing yourself is not a Ten Commandment. It is frowned upon, and they say you can't get into heaven for it.
But it's not written in stone.
It's not. It's just a guideline. Like, yeah. If you're thinking about killing your family, just leave. Don't even off yourself. Just go.
Just go. Just leave. You always have the option to leave any situation. Job, relationship, whatever. Just fucking leave.
Yep. If you've had enough, you must leave.
Just get out. So John worked out a plan. It was very well thought out and meticulous. He would murder his family so they would be spared from humiliation and would be able to go to heaven. He had hoped that he would be reunited with them in the afterlife. I have some quotes from him. As you said, he did do an interview in 2006 where he was very forthcoming about everything that happened and how he felt. And this quote, he says, "I finally decided the only way to save them from that was to kill them. It's just like D-Day. You go in, there's no stopping after you start."
Yep.
Yeah.
It's like D-Day.
John found an old 9mm pistol that he had bought as a souvenir from World War II and a .22 pistol. He bought new ammunition for these guns and took them to the shooting range for target practice before the murders.
Yeah, he wanted to make sure that he could physically do it.
He was practicing. One night after dinner, John asked his family what they would like to be done with their bodies after they die, which is a kind of a red flag and not the best after dinner conversation.
No, it's not. You save that. When is a good time to bring that up?
That's true, though. I mean, I'm not going to say that I haven't told people what I want done. So it's a
I guess when you're on your deathbed is the only acceptable.
Yeah. Even then, it's like, I don't want to bother you. I know you're going through a lot right now, but what do you want us to do with your body? Do you want us to burn it? You want us to bury it? He said, I remember talking about funerals and cremation and burials. I thought I was being real clever.
Fucker. Yeah, you're being real clever there, John.
Real clever guy. On November 9th, 1971, after his children left for school, John took his handguns out of his car, walked to the kitchen, and shot his wife from behind as she was drinking her morning coffee. Later saying, I approached all of them from behind so they wouldn't realize till the last minute what I was going to do to them.
That's cold as fuck.
Yeah. He then... But, go ahead.
I mean, it goes with his story, you know? Yeah. Like, he doesn't want them to know until, like, the very last second mm-hmm. or anything like that, yeah.
He then went up to his mother's apartment where she was eating breakfast. He kissed her, then shot her in the head.
Unbelievable.
I know. He went back downstairs and dragged his wife's body into the ballroom. He cleaned the blood so his children wouldn't see it when they got home. Okay. John left a note for the milkman to cancel the milk delivery. He also canceled the mail and newspaper deliveries. He then went to the bank where he cashed in all of his mother's savings bonds. He made calls to his children's schools and their part-time jobs, telling them that the family was headed to North Carolina for several weeks to visit his wife's ailing mother.
Yeah, talk about a list of things to do.
Yeah. He then took a break for lunch, making himself a sandwich, sitting at the same table he had killed his wife at just hours before.
Yeah. And he said that he told the guy that was giving him the interview, like, exactly that, as normal as anybody can possibly say it.
Mm-hmm. He said he was hungry and that's just the way it was.
It's just the way it is. You're a human being. You got to eat. You got to fuel your body.
You're burning a lot of calories doing what you're doing. You got to refuel. So
how are you going to kill the rest of your family on an empty stomach?
I mean, right? God, so cold-blooded. And after lunch, his children began to come home from school, and he killed them one by one as they arrived. First was his daughter, Patricia, the 16-year-old, who he shot in the back of the head. Frederick arrived next. He was 13 and the youngest. He was also shot in the back of the head. Now, this is weird. Weirder, I guess. John's son, John Jr., was 15, and he was arguably his favorite and his namesake. He was playing soccer that day. John left the mansion to go watch John Jr. play soccer. He then brought his son home and shot him once in the back of the head, but he kind of jerked a little bit. He didn't go as seamlessly, quietly as the other ones. So he ended up shooting John Jr. at least 10 times.
Here's how it went down.
Okay.
He's going to pick up his son from soccer. So he's sitting there watching his son play soccer for the last time before he kills him.
Mm-hmm.
They're driving home the whole time. You know, like, what's
he
going
knows
through?
He's going to kill him.
Yeah. And he's just so cold and collective about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he has to go through with it.
Yeah.
And then he gets home and he does it just like he did the rest of the family, except this time he has a death rattle,
mm-hmm.
which could possibly trigger his PTSD. So I think that's why he shot so many times.
That, and also, like, he was very big about them not suffering, and I think he was worried that John, like, hadn't died right away, you know? And
that
was
could
like,
be, boom, too.
Boom, boom, let me just empty these rounds or whatever. And ugh.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I know. So violent and awful. John then dragged the four bodies. It was only four because he said his mother was too heavy to move, so he left her up in her apartment.
And that sounds rude, but he literally, like, made that an entire paragraph.
About how fat she was?
Yeah.
Yes. He's, mm-hmm.
Like, these are his words, not ours.
Yes, he used the word fat, which is messed up. So he dragged the four bodies into the ballroom and lined them up. He put their bodies on sleeping bags. Then he drafted a letter to his pastor, which is what we were referring to about how he wrote, you know, about his mom being heavy. And everything. He told his pastor everything he had done. He had also written that his family would not be able to renounce their faith now that they were dead, because that was something he was worried about, that they were going to turn from their faith. And right. He had guaranteed their entry into heaven.
He did. Yeah, that's an amazing amount of authority.
It really is to be able to decide.
A mortal man can't just decide. I don't know.
I know
how that works.
I don't know. I don't get him. He meticulously cleaned the crime scene and then used scissors to remove himself from all the photos in the mansion.
That is like...
nutty.
Such a little girl thing to do.
It is.
It's like taking, you know, like burning pictures of your ex-boyfriend.
Cropping them out, stuff like that.
Anytime that you take scissors to a photograph, you're going through a really rough time.
Exactly. Like, you're not in the right headspace if you're cutting up photographs.
No.
And you're usually like a 14-year-old girl, like you said. It's a very childish thing. It's weird for him. I don't know. He slept there that night. While his whole family lie dead by his hand, he slept in that house.
Yep.
The next morning, he turned down the air to preserve the bodies. He flipped every light in the house on and turned the radio to his favorite classical music station. He then walked out the door and was not heard from for 18 years.
18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's just a house that was lit up and playing classical music for weeks.
A month. So the List family was known to be like quite reclusive. So it wasn't until one of Patricia's teachers got concerned about her absence. Even though John had told the school that they were in North Carolina, he remembered something that she had told him. Patricia had told him that she was worried her dad was going to kill her and her entire family.
Yeah, but just write that off.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
that's not a big deal.
That's not a big deal.
Well, I mean, the teacher couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong, and he convinced another teacher to go to the mansion with him. The neighbor saw people looking in the windows of the mansion and called the police.
I would have called the police when the student told me that her dad was trying to kill her.
Absolutely. But,
or at least, you know, hold a PTA meeting or something.
Like get a social worker to make a call, house call or something, just to assess the situation. Like I feel like that's something that you shouldn't take lightly, as a teacher, an authority figure.
Yeah, for real.
A 16-year-old tells you that. I mean, if it was, I don't know. It's just. He arrived at the mansion on December 7th, 1971. Upon entering the home, they heard organ music being pumped through the intercom system. It was like this funerally classical music through the whole house. It
like
was very
creepy.
Like an uplifting
type organ playing.
Yeah. Here. They found John's 5-page confession papers. In the confession, he explained that the bloodied bodies in the ballroom were his family and that he killed them out of mercy and saved their souls, claiming he had prayed over their dead bodies. How nice of him.
Oh, yeah, he's bad.
Yeah. The FBI did find his car at JFK International Airport in New York City, but there was no evidence of him catching a plane, and he was never found. The case soon went cold.
This is Chevy Impala. It's very nice.
Was it?
Yes.
What year?
I don't know. It was, I don't know. It was a later model.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It was 71, right?
Yeah, it was 71, so it could have been like
it's a
67.
Gotta be at least... Yeah.
Yeah. Baby. The following August, the List home caught on fire. This is just a little extra thing that I found super interesting. It was assumed that it was caught on fire from arsonist. It was discovered that the stained glass ceiling in the bathroom was signed by Louis Comfort Tiffany. This guy was the son of the founder and master designer at Tiffany & Company, which is a huge jewelry thing.
So the mansion burned down, right?
Yeah.
And they find out that this stained glass window could have solved all of their fucking problems.
Yes. So this stained glass window signed by him was it was worth over $100,000, which was said to have been more than enough to compensate for John's money problems, which I thought was just really ironic.
I don't know. $100,000 is only going to get you so far. I mean, they live in like a multi-million dollar mansion.
True. It would have been nice to have, had he known.
Yeah, would have.
Taken a little edge off.
They could have gotten a really nice duplex somewhere.
Yeah,
know?
Started over. Like,
they don't have to live in poverty.
Yeah. But yeah, it was.
Tiffany window, come on.
The whole time. Let's talk about Tiffany for a second. I've been getting ads on my Facebook, and legit, there were two paper cups that were Tiffany blue that they were selling for $1,000. Paper cups. They were just the Tiffany color, and they were selling them for that. It was insane. I don't know why they're thinking I can buy anything from Tiffany. They need to work on their algorithm a little bit.
Tiffany's, we're not the demographic for Tiffany, I guess.
No, not at all. 10 years later, in 1989, New Jersey prosecutors have an idea to reopen and shed new light on this cold case. In cooperation with Frank Bender, an expert forensic artist, they created a physical bust of John as Bender imagined he might have aged. He was given an older appearance, and psychologists theorized that he would most likely still be wearing the same kind of glasses, since they would perhaps remind him of his younger, more successful days.
That is such amazing profiling.
I know.
Like, they already know inside his head, in and out. It's so awesome.
Down to the freaking glasses.
Yeah.
So this bust turned out to be a near identical depiction of John. The bust of John was featured on an episode of America's Most Wanted on May 21st, 1989. 22 million people saw the sculpture of John, and tips came flooding in almost immediately.
Yes.
Two of the viewers were true crime fans, Wanda Flannery and her daughter Eva Mitchell. I just wanted to mention their names because...
They're heroes.
Heroes, yeah.
Amigos.
Yeah. They were pretty sure that their neighbor, Robert Clark, fit the description of the wanted man. Soft-spoken, an accountant, always wears a suit, a devout Lutheran. When they showed the bust of John on TV, they were shocked. It was Robert Clark right down to the glasses. And then they called the tip line.
He's wearing the same fucking glasses, man.
Same fucking glasses.
He didn't change his look at all.
Mm-mm. Turns out when John left the house that day, he did indeed drive to JFK International Airport, but he dropped his car off there and took the bus back to the city. From there, he took a train to Denver. Once in Colorado, he applied for a Social Security card under his new name of Robert Peter Clark. He got a job as a short order cook and built a new life. Starting over, fresh.
New beginnings.
Yeah. He joined a new church and ran a carpool for shut-in parishioners. At a religious gathering, he met his second wife, Dolores Miller. The two married in 1985.
On a side note, like the cops and stuff, like they were looking for, you know, John List forever.
Mm-hmm.
So every time one of the guys would go on vacation, they'd send a postcard and they would sign it John List.
Oh. Just to fuck with each other.
And it's kind of in poor taste.
It is a little bit, yeah.
You know, you're supposed to be trying to find this guy and you're making fun of the fact that you can't find this guy.
Yeah. I don't think they got the irony of that.
Yeah.
Like, you're not catching him, but you're making fun of the fact that you're not catching him.
A good laugh about it. They thought it was the funniest thing.
I didn't know that. That's crazy. Damn it. 9 days after America's Most Wanted aired the aged image of John List, he was arrested for mass murder. He was charged and convicted of 5 counts of first-degree murder. The trial began 18 and a half years after the murders, which is pretty crazy.
That is crazy. That's crazy.
At his sentencing hearing, he denied responsibility for his actions, saying, "I feel that because of my mental state at the time, I was unaccountable for what happened. I ask all affected by this for their forgiveness, understanding, and prayer." Fuck you, dude. You're not forgiven.
He knew exactly what he was doing the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Luckily, the judge wasn't having this crap and said, John Emil List is without remorse and without honor. After 18 years, 5 months, and 22 days, it is now time for the voices of Helen, Alma, Patricia, Frederick, and John Jr. to rise from the grave. He imposed a sentence of 5 consecutive life sentences, one for each victim, which was the max permissible penalty at this time.
Yeah, maximum.
So, good. He, of course, filed an appeal. He said that his judgment had been impaired by his post-traumatic stress disorder due to his military service.
There could be some truth to that.
Yeah. He also said that the confession papers he left behind were to his pastor and should be a confidential communication. Prosecutor, they rejected both arguments. And at the age of 82, he died of complications from pneumonia while in prison in New Jersey, which sounds awful.
It does sound painful, but that's cool.
He's gone. So yeah, that was John List. There's a couple of extra facts that I couldn't really fit in that I just wanted to mention, if that's okay.
Yeah, I have one.
Okay, go ahead.
John Walsh is a walking, living embodied of the fact that if you lose a child, you never get over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
He is, I mean, you look at the guy and he's just on edge 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But look what he's been able to do. I mean, with that energy of the grief and everything, he's channeled it into such a positive thing, which I think is the only way that you can survive something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Gotta think, like, I'm doing this for him and for him justice. And that's a terrible case. Poor, oh my goodness.
Yeah, poor John.
I know. That's terrible. But yeah, America's Most Wanted. I remember watching it when I was a kid and it freaking me out and loving it.
It's great.
It's so good. It's definitely one of the early true crime memories was America's Most Wanted. So there's just a couple of things like it is said that he was the inspiration for the character Kaiser Soze in The Usual Suspects, which I won't get into because if you haven't seen The Usual Suspects,
you don't need to know.
Yeah, I don't want to run it for you, but I thought that was pretty interesting. And for a time, it was believed that John List might be D.B. Cooper.
Mm.
Yeah, he disappeared around the same time as the airline hijacking. He matched the description of the hijacker, and he demanded $200,000 in the hijacking, which would have been about what John needed to get right with his finances, it said. He was questioned by the FBI after he was captured and denied any involvement with the D.B. Cooper case. The FBI no longer considers him a suspect, but I thought that was quite interesting.
Bullshit. He did it. He's
you think
Cooper.
He's D.B. Cooper? I don't think this guy's smart enough to be D.B. Cooper, but he did evade the authorities for 18 and a half years. So he probably is.
Yeah. I mean, if you're smart enough to move and change your name.
Yeah. He's a pretty smart guy now that I think about it.
Not really. He really isn't. He just moved and changed his name.
Yeah, he didn't change his appearance or anything.
Not at all.
It's not like he was a mastermind. I mean, I don't know.
It's just no one would have thought this. And it always comes back to people like ignoring signs and stuff like that. Like maybe this could have been prevented.
The teacher comes to mind. If he wasn't such a big baby and could have healthy conflict with people, maybe he wouldn't have killed five family members. You know, I don't know.
Air your grievances, people.
Yeah, don't let things fester. No, for you might snap.
That's true. I know that all too well.
So yeah, that was John List. He's a interesting guy. There's a lot out there on him, live interview wise. Before he passed away, they did an interview in 2006. Like I said, where he talks about everything, and he's a weenie, and I don't like watching it.
He's an L7.
L7 weenie. Yeah, he's a loser. Interesting guy. I mean, interesting case, though. Very sad. But yeah, that's John List.
It's just so cold. That's
It's the epitome of premeditated, man. Like, it was calculated. It was meticulous. It was cold. Like, I'm going to kill the kids as they come home from school one by one and put them in the ballroom. It's just, It's mind blowing. It's so
just leave.
Sad. Just leave. That's what I said. Like, I don't understand. Just leave.
I know that, you know, like some people be like, well, it's not that easy. You know, I can't just leave. It is that easy. Trust me. Just fucking go. Don't kill anybody. Everything's going to be okay.
It's just money.
Put that bottle down.
Yeah, it's just money.
You don't need that.
Don't kill your
family.
We
need each other.
Yeah.
During these times.
Just, you know. Yeah. He snapped. I don't think he snapped. I think he thought about it for a long time. He did think about it for a long time. I think it would be better if he had just snapped as opposed to the calculated, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like I can wrap my head around somebody like just losing it one day as opposed to, okay, so I'll kill Patricia at 3:25 and then Frederick will be home late. You know, that's fucked up.
Yeah. It's much easier to just step in cat vomit and then lose your shit.
Right. This is the last time I'm going to step in cat puke. I'm going to kill everybody in this house. Oh, that's not funny, but it is in a way. So that was it.
Yeah.
We have a shout out this week for sure.
Paige
is supporting the podcast now, which we appreciate so, so much. A really good time. We're getting some new microphones soon, which we're very excited about.
Thanks to you guys.
Thanks
and
to
amazing
you guys.
Support.
Absolutely. So.
And you have my promise that I am eventually going to, once this epidemic's all over and stuff like that, Laura and I are going to record together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to work. I'm worried about the audio quality here.
And I don't care.
I know.
I'm glad you are worried about it, but we'll get there. We're just beginning, you know, if we sound a little crappy, we'll look back.
I got the know-how. Right? I just need the finances.
Yeah. We know what we want.
We know what we need.
Yeah. So we're excited.
To bring the
about
greatest experience of Deadly Cereal to you. We know exactly what we need. We're just working our way up there.
We're working our way up to it. It'll just keep getting better. If you stick with us, we'll keep providing content and hopefully we'll sound a little better soon too.
Absolutely. And if you have any questions or comments, please email us at deadlycereal@gmail.com.
We would appreciate that.
Follow us on social media. We do live videos every now and then.
Yeah, we had our first live. It was a little shaky, but we pulled it out.
We did. It took some trial and error. A lot of error. A lot of trials.
A lot of error on my part. I apologize for that.
Oh, no, you're fine. It happens.
You think you're tech savvy, but you're so not. I'm not very tech savvy. I work for an internet
company.
We
need to stop pretending that we are. We're not fooling anybody.
No. And everybody knows now for sure. It was live. But just keep on sticking with us and we'll keep putting out content. We'll have a new episode next week and we hope you guys have a great week.
Absolutely. You guys stay safe out there.
Bye guys.
Deadly Cereal is only possible with your support. Please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and of course email us at deadlycereal@gmail.com. You can support our podcast by downloading the Anchor app or going to anchor.fm.
Deadly Cereal. Eat your ass.